This is the second episode of the third season of The Meridian, and we are once again recording at Lund Observatory, Sweden. Crossing our local meridian today, we are lucky to have Ruth Putkin, who works here at the Department of Physics. She studies those fundamental particles that make up the universe, and, more specifically, she's on a quest to find that elusive dark matter particle. After Ruth's interview, we will be bringing you some cosmic curiosities. What are cosmic curiosities, I hear you ask? Well, these are some ideas, events, or trivia from astronomic history. Yes, history has become legend, and legend has become myth. And some things that should have not been forgotten will now be rediscovered in our cosmic curiosities. More about that later.
Interplanetary galaxy formation.
Habitability.
The near-infrared wave.
Near-Earth asteroids.
Dynamical evolution.
Visible light.
Radio. The meridian.
Dark energy.
Exoplanets.
The meridian.
The universe.
The meridian.
The meridian.
The meridian.
The meridian.
The Meridian.
Wait a minute. Who's that?
Well, so, you know, you weren't here yesterday because you were a bit sick.
Yeah.
So we kind of had to improvise and I figured let's bring Lucian in.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was Lucian, who is a master's student here at the observatory.
Yeah, I know him quite well.
Yeah, he's in your research group, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Studying exoplanets. So thanks a lot, Lucian. And thank you for coming on with the cosmic curiosities that we'll have more about later.
Yeah, you absolutely did a great job at introducing everything.
Yes, brilliant, brilliant. Yeah. Nice. Well, I figured last week we sort of catched up with what I did on this year off, or especially what I did at ESO. But I'm curious, what did you do, Nick? Tell me all about what you did when I was away, because I seen you've been a bit of a globetrotter.
Oh, I was going to say not much. But, yeah, so I guess you remember my whole diary on La Palma from season two.
Amazing.
Yeah, except for the fact that I didn't get any data. So
you got to see a volcano.
Yeah, life-changing experience, no data. I think it was a fair trade. But anyway, I got the time back. So I went back to La Palma and, well, there was no volcano erupting.
Woo.
And not only that, we almost got two perfect nights of data. So
that's amazing.
Yeah, so I was so over the moon. Yeah, the night astronomer that was helping me was also quite impressed too.
What is a night astronomer?
So a night astronomer is someone who works at a telescope to assist you in your observation run. So almost every main telescope will have one of these, and they're the ones that know the ins and outs of how the telescope's working and can tell you and help you to fix problems a lot faster than you might be able to do it by yourself.
So, which is great.
Yeah. The NOD has a great program where it trains master's students on this telescope. So they get it to incorporate part of their education. So it's
that is really great. Also, what an experience to have as a master's student working at like a big telescope like that.
Yeah, exactly.
On a Canary Island.
Yeah, I know. In paradise, pretty much. So
I'm glad you got the data.
Thank you. Thank you. So, yeah, I did that. And then I decided to fly back to Australia for a friend's wedding. And then also I went to Hawaii to do some more observing. So I got some time on the Keck telescope, which is the really big.
Yeah, Keck is like one of the really, really, really big ones, right?
Yes. So I submitted a proposal thinking, hey, like, what's the worst that can happen? And the best happened again. So
that's amazing.
Yeah. So I was so shocked to be in that observing room. Like so many scientists want to be here. Like, you know, you imagine my childhood dream of becoming an astronomer. I was basically living that dream.
It's amazing.
I was also so nervous.
oh, so you actually, for the Nordic Optical Telescope, you really sort of get to sit and, you know, manage the telescope yourself.
Yeah.
Is it the same with the Keck? Like you actually sit in the control room and...
So it's a little bit different. So the night astronomer has more control over the telescope. You basically set up when to observe and what to observe.
Yeah.
But they just make sure everything is going smoothly. So
nice.
I had a lot of help. And once again, it was a perfect night and I got great data. So I got my ducks lined up in a row. Someone's looking down at me. I'm really happy. So on top of that, I also went to quite a few different conferences. Well, not quite a few, a couple. So I went to Las Vegas. Not to gamble, but to actually just to see an exoplanets 4, actually, where all the exoplanet experts sort of congregate together.
So including you.
Including me. So you think that like astronomers are a quirky bunch. Imagine if you get like a smaller group of them. Yeah. So we all think exoplanets cool, so we all got along really well. And I also went to a really big conference with a lot of European astronomers. So I think it was on the order of, 2,000 people were there. Yeah. So it was crowded as a lot of stuff.
I actually do remember that conference from my ESO visit, because all of a sudden, all of the ESO PhD students weren't there for a week.
Yeah,
exactly. It was empty.
It was fine. It was like half the department was with us. So it was quite good. And I also have submitted my first paper.
Yes!
Yeah.
This is great. This is like a huge thing. I'm very proud of you.
I'm really excited. And you're actually a co-author on it too. I know. So it makes it even more exciting.
I was very happy that you invited me, because you sort of invited me on the aspect of that. Well, I guess we shouldn't spoil your paper, but you have discovered very heavy elements in your paper. And as sort of like the in-house experts on heavy elements, you invited me to it and I was very happy.
Yeah, and you had some really interesting insights, which were great. And I think it sort of helped make the paper shine even better than it already has.
Aww.
Also, on a personal note, I got engaged.
This is amazing. I'm very happy. Congratulations.
Thank you. So, yeah.
So nice.
Yeah.
Will the wedding take place here or in Australia?
In Australia.
In Australia.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, boy.
We may try to do some hybrid thing in Sweden as well, because she is Swedish. But, yeah, the plans are up in the air at the moment, so we're trying to figure things out.
I'm very happy for you. Really,
thank you
congratulations,
so much.
Man.
Yeah, thank you.
It also goes to show, you know, we have life outside of telescopes and papers.
And science. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Enough to convince people we're interesting enough to be married. yeah, but I guess that's all about me.
Perhaps we should introduce our guest.
Yes, we should.
Yeah, who is Ruth Petkin, who works across the street on finding dark matter.
Oh, really? Oh, looking forward to that.
Yeah. And now I'd like to welcome to the podcast Ruth Petkin, who's a particle physicist here at the university.
Thanks.
So, welcome. I think we like kick it off. Could you like tell us a bit about yourself and what made you end up here at Lund University?
I can try.
Yes. Yeah.
So, for me to come to Lund, I think was there was a lot of luck involved.
Sure.
And sort of, you know, stars lining up in a way. So it was at the end of my first postdoc, so sort of 1.5 years after I graduated with my PhD, and there was this position announced, which was about going new ways in looking for dark matter to a large extent.
Yeah, yeah.
In combination with something that I had been doing before.
Mm-hmm.
The description of what this position was supposed to be sort of fit me perfectly. But then I thought it said something very intimidating in the title, something like associate senior lecturer or something
like that.
And I was like, oh, that doesn't sound like somebody can apply for this like two years after their PhD. So I was actually sending this around to sort of senior colleagues and friends and was like, don't you want to apply for this? And they were like, no, maybe not, but you should. And so I hesitated for a long time because I thought I would never have a shot at this. Mm-hmm. But then in the end, I figured trying can't hurt.
Yeah.
So I applied and I was invited to an interview. And in the end, I got the position.
Well, that's very nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Which was incredible. So this was really a sort of a, you know, it was just an opportunity that popped up. And I was very lucky.
Yeah. But I guess being in academia, you sort of learned that it's a bit about luck as well. Like,
I think it is very much. Yeah.
Yeah.
Luck and sort of timing.
The
right things have to happen at the right time. Like if this had come out half a year earlier, I wouldn't have applied.
No, sure.
Because I wasn't looking for jobs back then.
Yeah.
So, it's,
so you did your PhD at CERN, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah.
Or what did you do there?
So there I also worked on dark matter.
Yeah.
I guess we'll come back
to dark matter many times, I think.
So this was one part of my project. And the other one, which was why I actually was at CERN, was a more hardware-related project. So CERN has this technical doctoral student program where you are actually employed by CERN and you work on something that's a bit more technical, more hardware. And for me, it was what is called the central trigger of the ATLAS experiment. So ATLAS is one of the big experiments at the Large Hadron Collider. And a very important task we have to do when we take data with this experiment is what we call triggering.
Okay.
Because we get lots and lots of collisions. We get collisions 40 million times per second, roughly, and we cannot record all of this. But we also don't have to record all of this because most of it is not the things we're interested in. But we have to filter out the things we're interested in. And this is what we do at the trigger level. And there, the central trigger is sort of the first stage. So we have several stages where we take sort of more and more informed decisions. And at the first level, it's just we have to be very quick and very efficient.
Mm.
And it's actually an impressively small piece of hardware. So it's it's a box that is like, I don't know, half a meter wide and 30 centimeters large or something. And there are a couple of electronics boards in there. And they do some very simple algorithms because this system has to be very reliable and stable and easy to debug.
Sure. So just as if I understand, this is about like sorting which data to use and save and everything. There's a lot of data.
Exactly. So there's a lot of data and we only need a small fraction of
it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you need to figure out which one you need.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so this is the component that does the first step of this selection. And I was, part of the team. It's about, it varies a bit, but 5 to 10 people that sort of are responsible round the clock for keeping this thing working, because otherwise Atlas can't take any data.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. There's a lot of like things that comes in my head that I want to ask you, but I guess backing up a bit. So when you say collisions, what are you colliding in CERN? So, or in the Hadron Collider, I guess.
Yeah. So the Large Hadron Collider, mostly what it does is to collide protons and protons.
Mm-hmm.
It also has a couple of weeks every year where it collides protons with heavy ions, so lead mostly, or even lead-lead nuclei.
Wow, yeah.
This is not so much for the ATLAS experiment. I mean, ATLAS also takes this data, but this is for another experiment that's called ALICE, which focuses on these heavy ion collisions too. So sometimes we say that the LHC was built to sort of imitate the Big Bang and to study conditions shortly after the Big Bang. And it's really this experiment that does it, because if you collide these heavy nuclei at very high energies, you break them apart and you form, or at least it's believed, that you form a new state of matter that's called the quark gluon plasma. So all the building blocks of the protons and neutrons in the nuclei are sort of broken.
Yeah.
Well, they are separated and you get this soup of quarks and gluons. Like it could have been after the Big Bang. And then you can measure this and its behavior. And
how long does that, like, might be a super silly question, but how long does that state of like the quark gluon plasma last? Is it even possible to answer that? Or
okay, so I'm not a heavy ion physicist.
Sorry.
It's really short. It's these collision happens not quite as often, but it's on the timescale of, I guess, nanoseconds.
Oh, wow,
yeah. Something like that.
Yeah.
So it's,
I think it's,
or even less than that.
I think it's very impressive that we humans in a way have managed to build a machine that can mimic the conditions that was like seconds after the Big Bang. It's very impressive.
Yeah, I think so. And it continues to blow my mind. But,
So I want to ask the questions here, like, so particle physics, what more is there to discover? Like, don't we already know? Yeah, you talk about the protons, you talk about the quarks, and don't we already know about the particles? Like, what more is there to study?
Very good question. And I forget who it was, but there was a famous physicist who sort of said exactly this, maybe a bit more than like 100 years ago or so. He said, like, we're done. Physics is complete. We've discovered everything. And then actually people started discovering more and more particles.
Mm.
Like exotics particles, and then we realized that there is actually more than, you know, protons and neutrons and electrons. Nowadays, so you are right in that we've come very far in describing the ordinary matter, sort of the matter that everything around us is made up of. And so this is all the stable matter, and then there are some, you know, unstable particles that you can create, for example, in an accelerator. But all of this is described in what we call the standard model, which is our theory, and it works very, very well. And it, you know, it can explain, pretty much all the normal matter.
Sure, everything we see around us.
Yes.
Yeah.
But one of the big open questions that the standard model doesn't answer is dark matter,
right?
So this is something that we know from cosmological observations, where we see that essentially, you can do this in different ways and at different scales, but essentially you always see that the gravitational effects you observe cannot be explained by the visible matter.
Yep.
So you infer that there must be some kind of invisible or dark matter.
Sure, there's more mass there that we can see.
And the standard model doesn't contain this dark matter. It doesn't explain what it could be.
Yeah.
Or saying it the other way around, the particles that are described by the standard model cannot be dark matter.
Okay, yeah.
So there is something where we need something new. There are other phenomena, for example, in the standard model, there are particles that are called neutrinos that in the standard model are considered massless. But we know from experimental observations that they have a mass because we have observed that there are different kinds of neutrinos and they can turn into each other.
Yeah, right.
Which is something that can only happen if they have different masses.
Right, so there's a disagreement there between the standard model and what experimentalists actually measure.
Yes.
Intriguing.
Yes. So these are two of the sort of most obvious open questions. Then there are a few. Well, another big one is also the fact that there is only matter in the universe today.
Mm-hmm.
So if we again go back to the Big Bang, our, the naive assumption is that you created matter and antimatter in equal amounts. So in principle, if this annihilated, everything should have disappeared again.
Yes.
But it seems today that all the antimatter is gone, but some matter is left over.
And how did that happen?
We don't know.
Oh, that's so intriguing.
So something must have created an asymmetry in the amount of matter and antimatter, which is also something that's not explained in the standard model. We have some of these effects in the standard model that we can describe and understand, but they are not enough to explain the size of the asymmetry that we see in the universe.
Okay.
So these are sort of very blatant and obvious holes that we have in our understanding of nature. Then there are a few more subtle ones that have to do with questions of naturalness. So there it's a bit more... I mean, I don't want to call it a matter of taste, but it's cases where it could be a coincidence.
Okay.
But it feels very strange to a physicist.
Oh, okay.
That things should just have happened this way.
Okay.
One example is 10 years ago, almost 11 years ago, the Higgs boson was discovered at the Large Hadron Collider.
Yeah.
Which was big news.
And yeah,
which was
big great, news.
And which was a huge success for the standard model. That had predicted this particle to exist.
Okay, so that was predicted that it should happen or exist. You just need to find it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This was sort of the last missing piece to really make the standard model work.
Yeah.
But now we've measured the mass of this particle, and it turns out to be suspiciously light.
Mm-hmm.
So there are, this goes very deep into the...
That's fine.
The theoretical fundamentals. So we don't have to go there, but it's... sort of from a naturalness point of view, what you would have expected this particle mass to be, it would have to be orders of magnitude larger than what it is.
Sure.
So it's really somehow nature is sitting in a very weird corner of the landscape of possibilities.
And so you have to wrap your head around it in a way, I guess. Then because Higgs is the particle that gives other particles mass, or
yes, exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
Exactly. And this has, it's hard to grasp, but I have to say this is this is part of what I find so fascinating about particle physics.
Okay. Yeah.
That these particles have huge implications for both the history and the future of the universe.
Yeah.
And one parameter that the evolution of the universe is very sensitive to is the Higgs mass. So depending on what this mass turned out to be, sort of the fate of the universe could be very different.
Mm.
And So it's just one of these examples where these tiny, tiny particles have huge implications for how the universe came to be the way it is, so, and for us to be able to live in it.
Yes, it really is studying the universe, but on the very, very smallest of scales.
Yes. Which cool. I think is mind-blowing.
It is mind-blowing. Okay, so how much dark matter is there and how much standard matter is there roughly? Is it possible to know that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. It has been measured with actually quite precise by now. And it's round about 27% of like the whole matter energy content in the universe. 27% is dark matter.
Yeah.
And 5% is the standard model. Well, so there is about 5 times as much of this dark matter than there is of the standard model. So we've worked for about a century to figure out the standard model and everything, and it gives us 5% of the universe.
Yes, I guess my question on are we done is a bit... I can see how, we're not done. So how do you go about studying dark matter then? Of course, I get that it's not dark, but it doesn't seem to show itself to us in many ways.
No. Yeah, exactly. So this is also the reason why, even though, the first hints of dark matter were discovered almost 100 years ago.
Yeah.
So this has been around for a while, but all of this is on the cosmological scale.
Yeah.
But it's very hard to find the dark matter particles if dark matter is made of particles, which we like to assume as particle physicists. But it's maybe, you can ask that question.
That's a philosophical question almost, I guess.
But whatever they are, their interaction with our world, with the standard model particles, is very, very small.
Mm.
This is why we call it dark.
Yeah.
It's a synonym for we can't see it.
Yes.
it doesn't interact with our, or it doesn't interact very strongly. So the complementarity between the two parts of my research is, in one case at the LHC, we try to go one way, where we go to higher and higher energies, saying, okay, maybe these dark matter particles are very heavy.
Yes.
And this is why we haven't been able to see them before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we try to increase the energies so that we are able to produce heavier particles. And
that you do by the collisions or?
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
Exactly. So this is Einstein's E equals MC squared.
Exactly,
So if you put more energy in, you can produce heavier particles.
Mm.
The other way, this is the new thing that I started when I came to Lund, is going a different way where you say, well, actually the dark matter particles don't have to be that heavy.
Mm-hmm.
They can actually be sort of in the same mass range as particles we know, like the proton, somewhere between the electron and the proton, roughly speaking.
Yeah.
But in that case, you need another very, very weak interaction. So a new interaction that we don't know yet. And then you need a different kind of experiment because you're not so interested in high energies. You can stay at low energy, but you need a lot of statistics because these processes will be very, very rare because the interaction is so small.
Yeah.
So it's very unlikely for something to happen.
Mm.
So you have to gather lots and lots of data, even more data than we gather at the LHC in a way.
Is it possible, like, in terms of, like, how much data are we talking about? Like, it must be lots of terabytes, I guess.
Yes.
Perhaps it's not even possible to...
So, of course, it depends on the type of information you record for each event. But it goes into the petabytes. Far into the petabytes.
Yeah. Sorry for interrupting you. This other light, dark matter experiment setup, how does that look like then? How's that different from the CERN in terms of you're looking for the low energies?
So one big difference is that at the LHC, we are actually colliding two beams of particles, so protons in our case. What we are going to do here is to shoot a beam of electrons onto a stationary target. So we have just a very thin sheet of material that we bombard with electrons, and then we hope that in the collisions of the electrons with the nuclei in this material, we can produce dark matter. And then what we would see is that the electron comes out at the other end and has lost a lot of its energy.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't see anything else.
Okay.
And this is something that cannot happen in the standard model.
Okay.
So when the electron does this scattering in this material, in the standard model, you would always produce additional particles that you can see.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the dark matter would be, so if we see something like this, like electrons coming out with much less energy than they had before, this would
that
be a very clear.
That energy must have gone somewhere or?
Exactly.
Ah.
Because we conserve energy and momentum. And so if we can see that we suddenly measure less energy than we've put in, then we know that we have produced some particles that have carried away this energy that we couldn't measure. And this could be the dark matter.
Could be the dark matter. Because, I guess even so, you measure this electron that might have lost a bit of energy then. You still won't measure the dark matter itself as an indirect.
No, exactly. Yeah. We won't with our experiment.
Yeah.
So what our experiment would do would be, well, first of all, to say, there is something that's not in the standard model. It could also give hints as to the masses of these particles to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
But then actually other experiments would be needed to get a direct discovery of these particles.
Sure.
And there are, again, lots of different types of experiments that could do something like that. But the but our experiment could point to where to look next.
Yeah, exactly. It would,
in a sense,
pinpoint it a bit better, I guess, which is good. Yeah, what's the experiment called? Where is it being built?
You said it already. It's very innovatively. It's called the Light Dark Matter Experiment. or short, LDMX.
Okay.
And it's going to be built at SLAC, so the Linear Accelerator Center in California, Stanford. It's actually a quite neat idea. I didn't come up with it. Because there is an electron accelerator that is used for or meant for photon science.
Mm-hmm.
So you accelerate electrons and then you make them wiggle, and that causes the electrons to emit photons, and then you can use these photons to study materials and things like this. And this is mainly what they do. But they only use a fraction of the capacity of the accelerator. So there's actually lots of room for us to use the same accelerator without interfering with the photon science program.
That's great. So you're just using the leftover electrons in a way.
Yeah.
Nice.
So to say. So, and this allows us to sort of tailor an electron beam that suits our experiment very well. And this is, this is an electron beam that doesn't exist more or less anywhere else. At least not. So there are a few examples at a few different labs, but there we would never get the beam time that we need.
Mm.
So there, you always have to apply for time that you can use the beam, and that would never be enough as I mentioned, we need to gather a lot of data.
Yeah.
So, but at SLAC, we get the beam all to ourselves, so to say. So we can run, once the experiment is built, we can run 24/7. Essentially.
When do you expect it to be up and running?
We hope that, after 3 years from now, might be ready to
fingers crossed. That's very exciting. Yeah. Is this the main project like you're researching or like working on?
Yeah. Here? Yeah. At the moment, I've migrated away a little bit from the high energy LHC.
Nice.
Searches and now I'm focusing more on this experiment because there's a lot that needs to be done to get it in shape and ready.
It feels like it's very much looking for a needle in the haystack. Yes. But you seem to also be very driven by the quest in a way, which I find very inspiring.
I think it's as I said before, I think this is so fascinating that we can study really the smallest, tiniest objects there are. I mean, these are point-like particles, right? They don't even have a size.
Yeah.
And they are so important for what the universe looks like and for us to understand how the universe works and how it came to be like it is today. And, making a tiny little contribution to getting a step closer to understanding this, I think is really exciting.
It is super exciting. I really do hope you get more clues for dark matter. I'm rooting for you.
Thanks. I'll let you know how it goes.
Thank you. Thank you. Perhaps we can have you coming onto the podcast in a few years' time and let us know how it goes. I think with that, I'd like to thank you for coming here, Ruth. It's been great.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
It was a lot of fun.
This is Cosmic Curiosities. My name is Victor, and with me here at the microphone, I have Lucian Spitzner, who is a master student here at Lund Observatory, studying exoplanets. So Lucian, what cosmic curiosity have you brought with you today?
Hello, Victor. I have brought something today related to the heart of astronomy.
Okay.
Which is light. You know, us as astronomers, we always use light. We try to observe objects who are very close to us, like maybe the moon, or objects very far away, like other stars or even other galaxies. But what exactly is light? We today know that light is an electromagnetic wave and has properties of both a particle and a wave. But that was not always the case.
So what did people believe before that was the case?
There were a lot of theories about what light actually is. And one of them is that light had to propagate through some kind of medium, still as a wave. The same as water waves on the beach travel through the medium water, or sound travels through the medium air, is that light had to pass through some kind of medium. So people believed that there was some sort of substance that surrounded us all, everywhere, at all times, that allowed light to pass through. And this medium was called the ether.
The ether?
Yes, the ether. This ether was supposed to be luminiferous, that means light transmitting. Now, there are some problems with the theory of the ether. Namely, some problems expressed by Isaac Newton, who claimed that if there was something like an ether surrounding all of us, then all the planets should feel some kind of drag force moving through this medium. The same as if I move through water and I would feel a little bit heavier, you know, a little bit slower. The same way these planets should be slowed down on their orbit and eventually change their orbital characteristics, arguing that the orbital characteristics of these planets have not changed over, let's say, hundreds or thousands of years, he argued against the existence of this ether. Now, there was a German astronomer called Johann Franz Encke, and he lived in the 18th and 19th century. And in his work, he observed comets, asteroids, and planets, and he was especially interested in calculating the orbits of them.
So how was Encke's work connected to the ether?
He calculated the orbital time of a special comet now called Encke's comet. And what he found is that this comet did not obey to the calculations that he put down, so his observations were different, even when he included effects from other planets, like Jupiter, who often perturb the orbits of comets.
Right, right. Because it's not only the sun which sort of dominates how the planets move, but also the other planets.
Exactly. Mainly Jupiter, because that is the biggest other object in the solar system. So what he found is that there was some kind of other force apparently acting on a comet and changing its path around the sun. And no one really knew what this force was. Some people hypothesized that this could be exactly evidence for the drag of this ether.
Right.
So this comet was moving through this ether and thus slowed down a little bit, changing its path.
Right. So how would it change? Would the orbit be getting larger or smaller? Or
it would definitely be slowed down and thus fall closer to the star.
Right.
Now, that hadn't happened yet, and that's very important. We are still here,
and
we're not inside the sun yet, so that's good.
Lucky for us.
So there must have been another explanation for this force. We know now today that it is caused by evaporation of gases at the nucleus, so the heart of the comet. It gases out, and due to conservation of momentum, the gas streams off in one direction, so the comet has to slightly alter its orbit.
Right. So it's the comet that's actually losing mass, and that's what is changing the
orbit.
Right. That makes sense.
Now, that was actually an explanation that Encke himself also proposed, but at that time, back then, they weren't sure whether it would be ether or it would be some sort of outgassing. He did himself not state a clear preference, but also didn't really want to disregard the existence of the ether.
Right.
Oh, and there's one other cool thing. Comets might have not helped us in discovery of an ether, but the observations of the tails helped us discover the solar winds.
Okay, but are you absolutely sure then that we aren't surrounded by ether right now?
Yes, I'm positive. We now know that light travels as an electromagnetic wave, and comets change their path through outgassing processes.
This was the second episode of the third season of The Meridian. It was first published on March 17th, 2023. Hosting this episode, we had Rebecca Forsberg and me, Nicholas Borsato. Our producer was Anna Anadotti, and today's guest was Ruth Pertgen from the Department of Physics. The Cosmic Curiosity section of this episode was brought to you by Lucien Spitzner and Victor Jonsson. If you have any comments or questions about The Meridian, then feel free to reach out to us via our emails or via the Lund Observatory account on Twitter. The theme at the beginning of the show included the voices of Astronomics Ungdom, who attended a research school we hosted here at Lund University back in 2021. Make sure you tune into next week's episode when we will have Judith Court crossing our local meridian, talking about her work with exoplanets. And rest assured, there will also be some more cosmic curiosities. Thank you for listening. Mm-hmm.